designed to impose by force their kind of ideology on the United States. And in Israel, you have the same phenomenon going on. There's this extremely rigid, violent, homicidal Zionism that has taken hold over the years. And that's why the settlers are totally free to rampage through the West Bank. And it's why the IDF was tasked with committing genocide in Gaza. The view of Zionists towards the Palestinians is to engage in ethnic cleansing, to remove them from Gaza and remove them from the West Bank so that Israel can be a theocratic Jewish state. And that accords very much with Nazism, which viewed Germans as the Aryan race and views other quote-unquote races like Jews and other political factions like communists and gay people as Untermensch, you know, as undesirable human beings that could be disposed of en masse. And that's unfortunately what's happening in Israel and Palestine.
That was blogger and commentator Richard Silverstein speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening to KABU News In Depth. Thanks for being with us.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
Support for KABU comes from our members and from interviews with Charles Chambry, presenting the Spring Awakening Fashion Show on March 15th at Nomadic Vintage Rugs, featuring runway fashion, spring-inspired designs, and a night of style and culture in Portland. More information available at shorturl.at/tbf2z.
A lot of us don't want the police force in Mardi Gras representing the state government, which has introduced very anti-democratic laws about protests.
If you can't fly a pride flag steps from the Stonewall Inn at the National Monument for LGBTQ liberation, where can you fly it? So we put it back up.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. The Euro Parliament resolves that trans women are women, police abuse controversy clouds Sydney's gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, and the rainbow flag flies again at Stonewall. Those stories and more this week, now that you found This Way Out.
I'm Nico Raquel.
And I'm Rhett.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 21st, 2026. The European Parliament has approved a resolution specifically calling for the full recognition of trans women as women, just ahead of the 70th session of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, convening in New York City next month. The European Union's legislative body warns attacks by anti-gender and anti-rights movements undermine democracy and target women's and LGBTIQ plus rights. The Europarlament's February 11th resolution calls the inclusion of trans women essential for the effectiveness of any gender equality and anti-violence policies. It stresses recognition of and equal access for trans women to protection and support services. The vote was 340 to 141 with 68 abstentions. The Parliament's resolutions are non-binding, but they frequently inform the EU's negotiating position at global forums. The Europarlament's resolution puts the EU on a direct collision course with the United States at the UN conference, according to US trans journalist Aaron Reed. The Trump administration has officially denied the legal existence of transgender people.
HIV-positive enlistees are once again banned from serving in the U.S. military. The ban was declared unconstitutional in 2024 by a federal district court that called it irrational, arbitrary, and capricious. However, a three-judge panel of the Richmond, Virginia-based 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals found what it called a rational basis for the Pentagon's policy. In deference to the military, the judges agreed that excluding people living with HIV from enlisting was necessary to maintain medical standards. Under the February 18th ruling, enlistees are banned even if they have undetectable viral loads, which means that they could serve with no health limitations and cannot transmit the virus. Three individual plaintiffs who could not enlist or re-enlist based on their HIV status filed the original case in November 2022, aided by the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal. The organizational plaintiff is Minority Veterans of America. Lambda Legal has yet to announce its next move. It could ask for a review by all the judges of the Fourth Circuit or appeal directly to the U.S. Supreme Court. Rulings by the Fourth Circuit apply only to the states of Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. There is concern that this decision might influence the outcome of similar cases dealing with the military and non-military anti-HIV bias elsewhere in the U.S.
Intersex children are now protected from undergoing unnecessary medical procedures without their informed consent in the Australian state of Victoria. The multi-partisan February 19th vote in the upper house of the Legislative Council was 24 to 15. It passed in the lower chamber earlier in the month. The legislation bans surgeries on babies born with innate variations of sexual characteristics until they're old enough to decide for themselves. There are at least 40 variations of intersex characteristics that impact about 1.7% of the population, according to the national advocacy group Equality Australia. A panel comprised of medical experts and people with lived experience will oversee medical treatment plans for intersex children. Continued consent from parents and caregivers for medically necessary treatments will be required. An array of problems can be caused by unwarranted surgeries on intersex children, such as sexual dysfunction or infertility, urinary tract issues, incorrect gender assignment, and negative self-image in later life. Intersex advocate Tony Briffa of Interaction for Health and Human Rights said, "I felt a decades-long weight lift from my shoulders, knowing that what was done to me will never happen to another child in Victoria." The Australian Capital Territory is the only other part of the country that has similar protections for intersex children.
Anyone in the U.S. state of Kansas who's afraid they may have shared a bathroom in a government building with a trans person can now sue for damages unless the state finds the trans person first. Democratic Governor Laura Kelly's veto of the so-called bathroom bounty bill was overridden by Republican-dominated legislature. Among other provisions, the new law imposes a fine on individuals of $1,000 for not using the bathroom or other sex-segregated facility that conforms to the gender on their birth certificate. Those aggrieved by the presence of a trans person in what they consider the wrong bathroom can sue for that or much more. It applies to state buildings, including public schools and universities. Trans people will also be barred from updating their birth certificates or driver's licenses to reflect their gender identity, and previous updates will be revoked. Long a dream of Republican State Attorney General Chris Kobach. Governor Kelly condemned lawmakers for overriding her veto. Her statement read, in part, "It is nothing short of ridiculous that the legislature is forcing the entire state, every city and town, every school district, and every public university to spend taxpayer money on a manufactured problem. Kansans elected them to focus on education, job creation, housing, and grocery costs."
Finally, what was U.S. Olympic women's ice hockey team captain Hillary Knight's best day, February 18th, when she proposed to speed skater Brittany Bowe, or February 19th, the day of her team's epic gold medal win against arch-rival Canada? Hint, Knight says she was more nervous about the proposal. Knight and Bowe are two of at least 40 competitors who identify as LGBTQ at the Winter Olympics in Milan and Cortina, Italy. The women's ice hockey game between Canada and the United States featured at least 9 lesbians. Knight scored the first U.S. goal to send the contest against Canada into overtime. Teammate Megan Keller then scored the winning goal to secure a U.S. gold medal by a score of 2-1. This was Knight's 5th and final competitive hockey appearance. Her all-time total of 15 goals makes her the leading scorer in U.S. women's Olympics history. Bowe is a speed skating legend in her own right, with 91 World Cup medals, 22 national titles, 6 World Championship golds, 4 world records, and 2 Olympic bronzes, according to NBC News. She unfortunately failed to medal in Milan. Knight and Bowe met 4 years ago at the Winter Olympics in Beijing. The night before her thrilling appearance in the gold medal game, Knight got down on one knee and proposed to Bowe. Of course, she said yes, and the couple posted photos and announced their happy news on Instagram. They already own a home together in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the U.S. speed skating team trains. Their engagement this week was almost a literal storybook ending to their respective Olympic careers. As Knight said on Instagram, "Olympics brought us together. This one made us forever."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending February 21st, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. Informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Rhett. Stay healthy.
And I'm Nico Raquel. Stay safe.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Now it's time to rewind the rainbow. This is the Rainbow Rewind,
where we take a quick look back at the people and the moments that made queer history.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lunn.
This week, we honor the February birthday of Langston Hughes.
Don't you sit down on the steps, 'cause you find it's kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still going, honey. I's still climbing. And life for me ain't been no crystal star.
Despite not openly identifying as gay during his life, Langston Hughes is celebrated for his subtle, coded queer literary contributions, his intimate friendships within gay high society circles, and his foundational role in representing queer, Black, and marginalized lives.
Now let's rewind to a few February key queer milestones. In 2004, a number of United States jurisdictions began issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, including San Francisco, California, Sandoval County, New Mexico, and New Paltz, New York. Unfortunately, the licenses were later nullified.
And in 1967, The Black Cat Tavern in Los Angeles, one of the most well-known gay bars of its time, was the site of a massive protest against an extreme police raid and constant police harassment. Yep, that was 2 years before the more well-known Stonewall Uprising in New York. A reminder that our history is built on courage, creativity, and community.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind, because remembering our past fuels our pride. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is coming up.
Tensions surrounding this year's Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras have been as high as they were in 1978, when a queer protest turned into a police riot known as Australia's Stonewall. Against a backdrop of violent anti-Semitic and anti-Indigenous attacks and the relaxation of police restraints in response to them, parade organizers are faced with twin controversies. The queer Jewish group Dienu has withdrawn from the event due to safety concerns. There are also demands for the expulsion of the New South Wales police contingent after alleged abuses at a recent protest of the Israeli president at Sydney's Town Hall Square. This Way Out's Barry McKay heard from one of the parties in the police debate, a veteran of the 1978 confrontation.
Ken Davison, one of the organisers of the first Mardi Gras in 1978, which we held in solidarity with the struggles in California. You know, the first Mardi Gras was brutally attacked by police, and the body of law that allowed police control over public places and was the main body that was used against lesbians and gay men, as well as protests, is called summary offences. And in the first Mardi Gras, police contained the street and simultaneously demanded people exit, but prevented people exiting and arrested people. Now, what's happened is New South Wales has adopted extreme anti-protest laws, and on Monday, during the visit of President Herzog from the genocidal state of Israel, tens of thousands of people, it was certainly a lot more than the 7,000 or so, were at Town Hall Square. And again, the problem was the police prevented people entering and exiting while simultaneously demanding people disperse without any method of dispersing, and then did charges against people, including people with a lot of incapacity or a lot of older people. And then while people were being restrained, they were being hit badly. So I think the end result of that is that a lot of us don't want the police force in Mardi Gras representing the state government, which has introduced very anti-democratic laws about protests. And it goes back to the original conflict we had with the state government in 1978.
What are your concerns around the policing of the 2026 Mardi Gras?
I think there's two different things. There's one is the police there in uniform and with tasers and guns representing the police force and the state government in the parade, which is difficult if you're a person, you know, who's had a transgender person or an Indigenous person or other people that have had a bad history with police violence or police corruption. The second is the duty of the police as taxpayer funded to facilitate an event like the Sydney Mardi Gras, which, you know, in early years had a lot more people marching but didn't have as many spectators. And so most of the crowd control is done by Mardi Gras volunteers, unpaid. But the police need to manage things. And of course, if there's violent attacks, the police need to be able to respond. But in the past, police have tended to arrest people or beat people up, not necessarily with any justice. And also they're inclined to intensify anti-drug enforcement during the parade. The last issue is something we don't know, which is because a number of states and the federal government have adopted new laws around what they call hate speech, they're saying that particular slogans like Globalize the Intifada or From the River to the Sea, which is actually the election campaign of Netanyahu's party, or like accusing Israel of genocide, which, you know, a lot of international bodies have, they're saying that that shouldn't be permitted. Now, are the New South Wales police and Mardi Gras, are they going to enforce that in the parade? And the context is, in the last 5 years, censorship of the parade by Mardi Gras, by police, by the state government, by the sponsors, by the broadcasters, has intensified immensely. So now, we're not allowed to satirise any person in public life, for example. Now, all of this, I think, the leadership of Mardi Gras, the majority leadership of Mardi Gras and others are operating on behalf of the Premier Chris Minns, who's very sensitive to criticism about his failure in drug law reform, failure in equality legislation, intensified anti-protest laws, police violence and corruption. And, you know, this year New South Wales had the highest number of Indigenous deaths in custody ever. So things are not getting better. And also is his loyalty to Israel. So he's very sensitive to try and constrain Mardi Gras to tone down the sex and the politics.
Do you see Australia going in the same direction as the United States?
Look, I think it's more than that. I think certainly Trump is in the vanguard of destroying human rights and democratic rights and democracy. But if you look at a lot of European countries, Britain and France and Germany, Hungary, Poland, it's not something that's simply the United States. So democratic rights, the right to protest, the right to debate, media freedom, all of this is being rolled back. And partly it's on the excuse of defending Israel, but that's not all it's about. It's a general trend. And also the ruling class, for want of a better word, in each of these countries, including Australia, is seeing that their way forward is to exacerbate racism, to campaign on racism, to campaign against Muslims, against Arabs, against migrants, against Indigenous people. That's the main axis of right-wing politics, but not just in Australia, in United States, in France, in Britain, in a lot of countries, what were liberal democracies. So we're entering a new phase. Now, the problem is that sort of racist nationalism is never going to be any good for queer people. Like, nationalism like that, based on racism and chauvinism, is intimately linked with patriarchy and machismo. And there's no way we're not going to be victims of that.
That was 78er Ken Davis giving his thoughts on the participation of the New South Wales Police in this week's Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras Parade. For This Way Out in Sydney, I'm Barry Mackay.
Several of Ken Davis's 78er comrades have called for an independent investigation of the police brutality allegations. The Law Enforcement Conduct Commission is reviewing the complaints.
Every color on the pride flag is a symbol in the sky. Pride. And I'm proud to be me every time that I see that pride flag waving high.
The rainbow pride flag that flew over the Stonewall National Monument was missing the morning of February 9th. But New York activists were not having it. In 3 days, hundreds showed up on a cold and windy day to raise their flag again in defiance of the Trump administration. Paul DiRienzo of WBAI was on the scene.
When I say stronger, you say together. Right. Stronger.
Together.
Stronger.
Together.
Louder.
Together.
What does it mean to you that this flag got taken down?
That the flag got taken down?
Yeah, and the folks didn't want to put it up.
It's trying to erase us. Yeah, can't do that.
You know, how did you hear about it? What did it make you feel when you first heard about it?
When I first heard about it, I thought, doesn't the government have more important things to do than trying to make us disappear?
You think that's what they're trying to do here?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You have a message for the president and this, whoever the Secretary of Interior is?
I do have a message, but it can't be delivered in language that I want to hear that I want anybody to hear me speak in.
All right, cool.
You know, I think our community is coming together in a way they always do when we're faced with censorship and oppression that the current political regime has brought upon us once again. And I think mobilizing the power of young people and young voices in a time when our community is under attack has always allowed us to persevere and to
How does Sherry make you feel that they're putting the flag back up here?
Empowered and optimistic for what this year and what, you know, the opportunity for us to let our voices be heard.
I was at home when I read about it.
New York City comptroller and congressional candidate Brad Lander.
Trump does something to make you sick to your stomach almost every day. You know, they call it that whole like shock and awe or muzzle velocity where you're still trying to focus on how he took over Venezuela or, you know, how people got shot on the streets of Minneapolis, one of whom is, you know, lesbian. So to have this, you know, obviously a flag, well, he wants to do everything he can to make people feel like disheartened and afraid and angry. But what we showed today was we all show up, re-raise that flag, just keep fighting back. Look, these are not normal times, and when you try to step on people and erase their history and deny their rights, you should expect at least, you know, that they're gonna fight back. I'm running for Congress right here in this district to bring the fight to Donald Trump and to secure everybody's rights in this city and country.
Very good. Thank you very much. You were discussing like the Epstein files and all these people. I mean, the disgust of it is beyond belief. And then they take down the flag here. I mean, the juxtaposition of those two events are shocking to me.
But they're very similar.
The district's U.S. Congressmember Dan Goldman sat on the committee that tried to wring answers about the government's files on pedophile sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein from Attorney General Pam Bondi.
It's the elevation of Donald Trump and his own view of himself and everyone like him, as opposed to anyone who is not like him. He is trying to protect himself and his cronies who were involved in some capacity with the Epstein files, to the point where they would not even allow victims to come and give testimony because they did not want to help them, they did not want to defend them, and they did not want to have more evidence to potentially prosecute more people. And it's the same thing here. They are now attacking the LGBTQ community. They've been trying to whitewash black history since the beginning. They are coming after every single group that has traditionally endured discrimination or persecution and trying to attack them so they can return to a white supremacist 19th century world.
Disgusting. Beyond disgusting. It's horrible. It's like every day you have to wake up to something else this maniac is doing. No, it's horrifying. I'm scared we're going to have a military state. I'm scared we're turning into a police state and we won't have the freedoms that we had before and that there's no humanity. We have lost humanity. That I think troubles me more than anything else. We can't look at each other and feel empathy for one another.
City officials brought a shorter plastic pole for the new rainbow flag, but the crowd demanded it be the same height as the Stars and Stripes. Some even thought the U.S. banner should be taken down, but some clever protesters jerry-rigged a way to wed the two flags.
What we saw here today was re-raising the flag. The community, you know, wanted to make sure that it was hung properly and strung through the ropes. That's what they did, and I think it looks pretty good.
Manhattan Borough President Brad Heuermann-Sigel.
What's next after this, you know?
Well, I think for us, I think it's a matter of ensuring, you know, that we continue to speak out. I mean, it's not just about raising a flag. It's about taking to the streets, speaking on behalf of immigrants, transgender youth, really making our voices heard. Going to court, representing our community where we can. I think for us as a community, it requires constant vigilance. And for New Yorkers, generally speaking, we, you know, appreciate their allyship. And we saw today an enormous response to what was a deplorable act on the part of the White House, you know, removing a flag. at the heart of our civil rights movement. If you can't fly a pride flag steps from the Stonewall Inn at the National Monument for LGBTQ Liberation, where can you fly it? So we put it back up, and I'm proud of the community for its response.
The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
I am introducing legislation to designate the Pride flag as a congressionally authorized flag in America, and that means it can be flown here and everywhere else. And no one can take it down.
The removal of the rainbow flag from Stonewall is the tip of the Trump iceberg. While Schumer's legislative approach and a Lambda Legal lawsuit target the Stonewall incident, another lawsuit filed in Massachusetts challenges the entire Trump agenda of scrubbing unwanted history from national parks.
Doesn't it just fill you with pride? Loving who you are on the inside. Wave that pride flag up high. Be true to you. Be true to you.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Nico Raquel and Rhett and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written by Sherry Lunn and produced and co-hosted with Brian DeShazer. Barry McKay produced the Ken Davis interview. WBAI reporter Paul DiRienzo provided the on-the-scene sound at the Stonewall Monument Pride flag re-raising that was edited by Greg Gordon. Thanks also to Robert Henley. Midnight Oil, Arca, and drag queen Nina West performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Lee Sloan of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WGOT Gainesville, Florida, 2MCE Bathurst, New South Wales, Rainbow Radio, New York, New York, and a wide array of community terrestrial internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Listeners, sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KVU FM in Portland.
In ancient Egyptian creation theology, the creator god is presented as androgynous. There are two men buried in one tomb named Nianchanum and Chanumhotep, and they live about 2450 BCE. And in their tomb, they're shown embracing as if they're almost about to kiss. What we see in a possible Book of the Dead reference denying same-sex activity is that it was frowned upon, but not something that would have been legally punishable.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Uganda lesbians face life in prison for kissing in broad daylight. Senegal's PM pushes increased anti-queer penalties. And Dr. Darnell discusses ancient Egyptian androgyny. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Melanie Keller.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With News Wrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 28, 2026. Wendy Faith and Alessi Diana Denise are facing life in prison in Uganda for kissing in public. Police raided the Arua City apartment where the two women have lived since last year after their neighbors passed along photos of them engaging in behavior they deemed sexual. To veteran Ugandan activist Frank Mugisha, the February 18th arrests underscore the grim reality we are facing on the ground under the Anti-Homosexuality Act. Critics have called the 2023 measure the Kill the Gays Law. It prescribes the death penalty for what it defines as aggravated homosexuality. That includes multiple arrests, knowingly spreading HIV/AIDS, or having sex with minors, disabled people, or other vulnerable partners. Consensual adult same-gender sex can be punished by up to life in prison. Numerous human rights groups in the East African nation and around the world have condemned it. Faith and Denise are among the first to be arrested under the law. They were briefly free on bond, but were rearrested when they were lured back to the police station to retrieve their phones. The first prosecution under the law was dismissed February 2nd, when the court determined that the defendant's long pre-trial incarceration had rendered him mentally incompetent. Police spokesperson Josephine Angusha said that the investigation into the women in their 20s is ongoing. In her words, "Information was received from the community that the suspects have been involved in queer and unusual acts believed to be sexual in nature, besides being allegedly seen kissing each other in broad daylight." Faith is a local musician and internet celebrity, and neighbors also complained about groups of women dancing and sleeping over. Mugisha says Faith and Denise's friends are concerned about their safety under the Anti-Homosexuality Act, and so is he. As he told the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation,
"My worry is if I don't feel safe being a very known, pronounced activist who has been able to maneuver and live in this country for a long time, how are the other people feeling? And if I'm not able to go out and help other people, then that's becomes very risky for everyone. I don't feel safe. I have to watch my back all the time at this point because of the worry I have, because of what I'm seeing happening."
Increasing the penalty for what it calls unnatural acts in Senegal is the goal of a bill introduced by Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. On February 24th, he brought Parliament legislation that would raise the penalty for consensual adult same-gender sex to a term of 5 to 10 years in prison. Promoting homosexuality would carry a 3 to 7 year sentence. Queer sex with a person under 21 gets the maximum sentence of 10 years. The law would also punish anyone who accuses another of same-gender sexual offenses without proof. The bill broadens the definition of unnatural acts to specify that any sexual act or act of a sexual nature between two people of the same sex constitutes an act against nature. Proposed penalties include fines for convicted offenders, equivalent of almost $18,000. Consensual adult same-gender sex has been a crime in the socially conservative West African Muslim-majority country since its independence from France in 1960. Sonko is resisting pressure to increase the status of so-called unnatural acts from a misdemeanor to a felony. He told reporters, "We can achieve the intended objectives without going so far as to elevate the acts." Human Rights Watch and similar global rights groups see an alarming increase in negative reporting on same-gender sex in the national media and a police crackdown in recent months targeting the LGBTQ community. Senegal's elite police force arrested 12 men in February for engaging in unnatural acts and for the deliberate transmission of HIV. No date has been set for Sonko's measure to be debated in the National Assembly.
The gay dating apps Grindr and Blued are now blocked in Malaysia. The Malaysian Communications and Multimedia Commission is cracking down on apps that it says spread lewd or immoral content, exploitation, abuse, scams, exploiting children, or threats towards public safety. Both Malaysia's secular federal and state Islamic laws criminalize same-gender sex in the mostly Muslim Southeast Asian country. Anal sex can be punished by up to 20 years in prison, regardless of the partner's genders, along with cannings and fines and deportation for foreigners. Communications Minister Fahmy Fadil's February 25th announcement about blocking the queer apps came in response to a question from a member of the powerful but minority Pan-Malaysian Islamic Party. They asked what the Communications Commission was going to do about the two apps that were promoting deviant relationships. The conservative federal government has tried to divert the national media's attention away from more pressing issues by sensationalizing its mounting attacks on LGBTQ people. Grindr and Blued have been rebranded to Heisei, according to the South China Morning Post. That's H-E-E-S-A-Y. Its management has yet to issue any public comment about the online blockade.
There are no more puberty blockers for transgender minors in the United Kingdom. Participants in government drug trials at King's College were the last to officially receive the medications. The trials were prompted by the highly controversial 2024 CAS report. CAS had challenged the efficacy of what experts consider life-saving treatment for trans patients under the age of 18. That current study has now been disrupted by social pressure from anti-trans influencers such as J.K. Rowling. The Harry Potter author described puberty blockers as an unethical experiment on children who can't give meaningful consent. The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency caved to their criticisms. So the Department of Health and Social Care declared a pause to the study, claiming new concerns directly related to the well-being of children. Gender Plus director Dr. Aidan Kelly was disappointed but not surprised by the pediatric gender-affirming healthcare ban. The leading gender care doctor and clinical psychologist told Pink News, "They keep talking about young people's safety and well-being as the primary importance. However, in his opinion, the premise for the trial was flawed in the first place, and now it's running into problems because the National Health Service has conceded so much ground to the anti-trans lobby."
Finally, the U.S. state of Kansas is revoking all government documents that reflect the gender identity of trans citizens, and two trans men are filing suit. The new law passed by the Republican-dominated legislature over the veto of Democratic Governor Laura Kelly requires trans citizens to surrender their driver's licenses and birth certificates or face misdemeanor charges and substantial penalties. They are also banned from using bathrooms and other single-gender facilities in government buildings that don't match their birth gender, even highway rest stops. About 1,700 trans Kansans started receiving letters from the state's Division of Motor Vehicles this week, informing them their driver's licenses and other government documents would be invalidated immediately when the law went into effect February 26th. Ironically, the letter ends with an apology for any inconvenience. Plaintiffs Daniel Doe and Michael Moe are represented by the American Civil Liberties Union in a lawsuit focusing on driver's licenses. They charge that the measure violates major civil rights guaranteed by the Kansas Constitution, such as privacy, personal autonomy, equality under the law, freedom of expression, and due process. The law forbids trans Kansans from changing the gender marker on driver's licenses and birth certificates in the future, and Doe and Moe are challenging those provisions too. Senior staff attorney Harper Selden warns that the new law threatens to out transgender people against their will every time they apply for a job, rent an apartment, or interact with the police. He calls the measure a cruel and craven threat to public safety, all in the name of fostering fear, division, and paranoia. Democratic State Representative Abby Boatman is the state's lone trans lawmaker. She told the Kansas City Star, "The persecution is the point."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 28th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay healthy.
And I'm Melanie Keller. Stay safe.
Our Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Brian DeShazer, self-proclaimed armchair Egyptologist, has been fanboying over Dr. Colleen Darnell, award-winning Egyptologist trained at Yale University and vintage fashion enthusiast. Colleen is a world expert on ancient Egyptian culture and daily life, co-author of Tutankhamun's Armies and Egypt's Golden Couple, when Akhenaten and Nefertiti were gods on earth, with her husband Dr. John Darnell. Brian discovered her in National Geographic's Lost Treasures of Egypt. In this conversation, Brian explores with her the queer lives, love, and identities of the Nile's ancient civilizations.
Welcome to This Way Out, Dr. Colleen Darnell, an ancient Egyptologist and a vintage fashion enthusiast. And let's just get that out of the way, because I want our queens and our drag queens and our stylists and our designers to go to ColleenDarnell.com and follow her on Instagram so you can see her Great Gatsby fashion, and she collects vintage from that era, the 1920s. So imagine Louise Brooks with that blunt haircut from Pandora's Box, you know, hiking around the temples and tombs. And the first thing I want to ask you, Colleen, is how did you decide Egyptology was your field of study, and what excites you about it?
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here. So my interest in ancient Egypt, it goes back to childhood. I considered other career options because Egyptology isn't always the most practical field to go into, although I've been so fortunate to be able to make it my career. And I went to Yale University, both for my bachelor's and my PhD, to be able to study Egyptology formally, and now I get to teach it to people all around the world.
And also through the television, I found you through Lost Treasures of Egypt, and it's just exciting to follow you and watch your scholarship and your discoveries. I guess we want to start at the top with the cosmology of, like, what did ancient Egypt even think about it?
In ancient Egyptian creation theology, the creator god is presented as androgynous, because at the moment of creation, or even before creation, in the primordial waters of Nun, you have the potential for everything to exist, and yet it hasn't been differentiated. For the Egyptians, the process of creation was the process of making balanced pairs and going from a original unity to the multiplicity to the millions of creation. So the god Atum, or Re, multiple names are given to the creator god. Here I'm speaking about the creation theology of the city of Heliopolis, the main cult center for the sun. And when Atum Re begins to create the world, he creates light. So you have that pair of light and darkness. You have dry earth in the primordial waters. And then he creates the first god and the first goddess. And upon that moment of creation, then additional gods and goddesses are created, and then people and plants and animals. So the creator god has to have within himself everything.
I've seen sort of gender transformation through depictions on the walls, queens depicted as kings. So you can talk about how they use gender.
There are two really good examples of this. One is the famous woman who became king, queen who became king, who is Hatshepsut. And because kingship is a male office, she does something interesting when she becomes co-pharaoh with her nephew, Thutmose III, in terms of an artistic transformation. And it's important to note that we don't actually know how she would have dressed in real life as a woman ruling as pharaoh, although the likeliest scenario is that it would have been something like a hybrid of a woman's dress with a male kilt tied over it, which we know did happen in the late 12th dynasty for a female pharaoh named Sobek-Nofru, who unfortunately don't know very much about, but we have a fragmentary statue where she's wearing a dress and has the royal kilt because she was another queen who became king.
And what we see in Hatshepsut's art is at the beginning, she's shown as a queen, wearing a dress, wearing typical queenly regalia. Then she goes through an androgynous phase where she's dressed as a male king, but her body is essentially halfway in between a male and a female body according to ancient Egyptian artistic conventions. So her breasts get smaller. You can still recognize her face for certain. And throughout all of this, the texts, the hieroglyphic texts that label these statues or that describe her in her temple at Jor al-Bahri are grammatically feminine. And this persists even when she's shown fully male, virtually identical to her co-ruler Thutmose III. And we don't know over the course of, you know, 7, 8, maybe a few more years, what really triggered those artistic transformations. But it's about presenting herself as a woman who's ruling as king, but her name is actually marked as feminine. It's she who is foremost of the noble ladies, and she doesn't change her birth name. So there was no doubt about the fact that she continued to be a woman throughout her entire reign. So in the same dynasty as Hatshepsut, but a little bit later, we have a king named Amenhotep IV come to the throne. And at the beginning of his reign, he looks just like any other 18th dynasty king. He has a powerful torso. He's very trim. He's young. It just is this idealized representation. A few years into his reign, he changes the way that his body is represented. He suddenly has more of a belly, these attenuated, thin limbs, very long face, and a core and thick thighs and a much wider representation of the hips. So according to ancient Egyptian artistic standards, he's feminizing his own body. And we see this in a very dramatic way in a colossal statue at Karnak Temple, some of which depict him as a male king with those unusual proportions, but still clearly wearing a royal kilt. Others, however, seem to show him almost with a feminized form where he's nude, but there are no genitalia represented. Some people claim it's Nefertiti, but it doesn't seem to work out that way. And what Akhenaten and Nefertiti, by showing themselves with these bodies that look very similar to one another, what they seem to be representing is that they are going back to the time when gods have first been created. So they're androgynous because they're trying to show themselves closer to the creator god. What we see in the art of Hatshepsut and Akhenaten and Nefertiti is using the conventions of Egyptian art to represent the male and female body in a way that can then express political theology.
You are listening to Egyptologist and vintage clothing enthusiast Dr. Colleen Darnell on This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer.
So now let's get down to the reality of what life was really like for the regular Egyptians and what queer life might have been or what evidences we have. Of course, my Wikipedia search, Dr. Colleen Darnell, brought up the two, what you told me was basically the manicurists and the hairdressers. Tell me about them without breaking any stereotypes.
There are two men buried in one tomb, named Nianchanum and Khnumhotep. And they live about 2450 BCE, about a century after the Great Pyramid at Giza. And within their tomb, they are depicted in what for ancient Egypt is a very unusual fashion. They're shown embracing as if they're almost about to kiss. They hold hands. They are seated together at a banquet. And all of these representations are what we expect for a man and his wife, but not for two men. However, although they have been interpreted as a same-sex couple, and that is possible, the evidence really points in another direction. And what it actually points towards is that they're identical twins. And because there are certain ways that you can represent people in a close relationship, the canons of art, the proportions, the way the figures are relate to one another are taken from married couples but applied to the identical twins. A couple pieces of evidence that suggest that. One is their names. They both have the name, the divine name Khnum, within their name, Ni'ankh Khanum. To Khanum belongs life, and Khanum Hotep. Khanum is pacified, is peaceful. And that would make sense if they're identical twins, and so it's a similar naming pattern. Within the representations, they do have families, but they also have these really interesting representations of twinned animals. So, for example, when they're fishing, there are two fish on their spears. When they're fowling, there are these two birds interacting. They also have the same profession. They are overseer of the manicurists of the king, because everyone attached to the royal court, this would have been a very important relationship, intimate relationship, in close proximity to the king. So all of the evidence seems to point towards them being identical twins, as opposed to being in the same-sex relationship. But we can't entirely rule that out, because the hieroglyphic texts don't say explicitly they're twins or they're brothers, but that's how we can read the iconography in the most contextually based way for ancient Egypt.
So how are the other ways that we might find evidences? I'm thinking of, you know, they lived in homo social societies in the temples. Priests and priestesses lived together. And we also wanted to separate the idea of sexual physical sex and sexual relationships, emotional relationships. So what do we look for when we look for those things?
Within hieroglyphic texts in tombs or temples, we wouldn't expect explicit descriptions of relationships, and we don't have any expressions of emotional relationships between two men that are directly stated, nor two women. In literature, we also have very few references to same-sex physical activity. What we do have is a couple of references in literature. One is in a New Kingdom tale that does actually have earlier origins, called The Contendings of Horus and Set. Set is the older god. He's powerful. He represents these chaotic forces. He's not evil, despite the fact that he does murder Horus's father, Osiris, but he's chaotic. He's unpredictable. So what we see both there and in a possible Book of the Dead reference denying same-sex activity is that it was frowned upon the same way as adultery, but not something that would have been legally punishable as far as we can see from the sources. We also have a literary tale of King Pepi II having an affair with a general, but unfortunately, we don't have the end of the story. So it seems to be presented in a negative light, but we don't know how it's going to turn out in the end. And that's really interesting to see. So they're certainly thinking about this. It's certainly present in ancient Egyptian society, but it seems like they viewed it negatively, but weren't so concerned that they're really going to talk about it or make it a significant feature of something that is considered immoral or punishable. And I find that really interesting, how they deal with all of these potential relationships.
One of the things you wrote me was about a love spell that I wanted you to tell our audience about.
So this is a Coptic text. So it is written in the Greek alphabetic script with a few extra letters, but it is the ancient Egyptian language. And when Coptic was being written, Egypt, most of the population of the Nile Valley, nearly all the population of the Nile Valley, had converted to Christianity. And this is a magical spell. It actually uses magic words, which is really fun. And the purpose of the spell is for a man to gain power and coerce the love over another man. And throughout the spell, it describes the basically invoking these dark powers to torment the other man into, if he sits down, don't let him sit. If he wants to sleep, don't let him sleep. But instead, have him come after me no matter where I happen to be. So it seems to be out of desire, but it's more intended to coerce rather than necessarily cause an emotional attachment.
What do you hope to find next?
over the summer, starting in June, I'm actually going to return to Neil-Khnum and Khnum-Hotep in a class called Lives in Ancient Egypt. And I'm going to focus on the lives of particular individuals for which we have tombs or autobiographical tags or stelae in temples. One of the lives I want to do is actually that of the sacred Apis bull, because we know a lot about how he was mummified and where he was buried. So really kind of showing that personal connection. I'm looking forward to going back through all the texts in some of these tombs to see what else we can say about how they lived their day-to-day lives.
Dr. Colleen Darnell, thank you so much for joining us, and you have a great day, and we'll be watching you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Thanks to Dr. Colleen Darnell for this journey into ancient Egypt. To hear the extended interview, including a story we couldn't air on the radio, visit This Way Out Radio on SoundCloud.com. Check out her live Zoom classes on hieroglyphics and special lectures at www.ColleenDarnell.com. Follow her on social media for all things ancient Egypt, and don't forget the fabulous fashion. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsRep was reported this week by Melanie Keller and Tanya Kane Perry and produced by Brian DeShazer, the producer of this week's feature with Dr. Darnell. You heard music from Midnight Oil, Mashu Leila, Lorena McKinnitt, and Ancient Egypt by Simeon Kravinko Adamoff, the latter licensed under an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives 4.0 international license. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on CJAM Windsor, Ontario, WRPI Troy, New York, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings.